Hello and welcome to Anesthesia on Air. My name is Owen Dorr. I'm the podcast fellow at the college. We've got a slightly different episode today. We're hosting the fantastic content from TopMed. We think you would be really interested in it. It's about a very hot topic. It's about the role of AI in anesthesia. We've got some fantastic insights from James Bowness. So we hope you enjoy.
TopMed Talk.
This is TopMed Talk, the broadcasting arm of EBPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. The EBPOM World Congress is taking place this year between the 7th and the 9th of July at the British Library in London. Check out ebpom.org now.
Hello, welcome to TopMed Talk. I'm Andy Cumpsty and I'm here in Birmingham at the Anesthesia Research Meeting, which is a fantastic 2 days of all the kind of key speakers in anesthesia research in the UK. This year it's been held with the ARS, the Anesthesia Research Society, and the Royal College of Anaesthetists at the library in Birmingham. It's a really interesting venue. And we've just come out of the first session here this morning with three fantastic speakers. I'm really pleased that one of them has agreed to come and chat to us straight away. You know, it's a real pleasure to welcome Dr. James Bowness to the podcast. Welcome to TopMed Talk, James.
Thanks, Andy.
So James, you're a consultant anaesthetist and an honorary associate professor at University College London. You've got lots of interest in regional anaesthesia, but you're one of our world-leading experts on AI in the perioperative space, is what we're going to talk about today. You're the lead for AI workstream for the AAGBI?
Yeah, or now the Association of Anaesthetists.
Yeah, and you chair the AI Working Group for the European Society of Regional Anaesthesia.
That's right.
So lots of experience in this space, but also lots of direct involvement with industry and lots of work with the college about how to really drive AI forwards.
That's right, yeah. Also employed for part of my time by GE Healthcare working in this space. I've undertaken some consulting work with a number of companies in Europe and the US in this field, and current projects, which I'm sure we'll touch on, partnering with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Associatist and UCL Partners, an innovation organization in London around healthcare AI, particularly in anaesthesia, perioperative medicine and acute pain.
Fantastic. So before we dive into all that really interesting stuff then, let's start off right back basic. When we're talking about AI, what do we mean? What sort of things does it cover? What sort of things does it not cover? And how does that really impact us and as in our perioperative space?
Yeah, it's a good question because we've all heard of AI, but it can mean different things to different people. And that's because it's a broad church with many individual disciplines within it. The term artificial intelligence in its totality was coined by someone called John McCarthy in 1953, computer scientist who convened a meeting, I think it was in Dartmouth College, of like-minded individuals the summer of 1953 to sort of discuss this field. And that term, that definition that he or they came up with was the field of computer science which tries to enable computers to perform tasks traditionally associated with human intelligence. Obviously that is a lot of individual tasks and applications, but also there's a variety of computational techniques that encompasses. Deep learning, a very popular one, and still is. That is where it's a form of machine learning where you can encode artificial neurons in a neural network. An artificial neuron is essentially a mathematical function which will take a data input, process it, and put out another data set. The algorithms can encode multiple neurons, which are arranged in layers. As the data goes in, it's handled and passed to the sequential layers, providing conceptual depth. And at each layer, information is extracted. That happens, coincidentally, to be particularly adept at handling imaging data and the application of machine learning or deep learning applied to the visual world is sometimes called computer vision. There are other fields within AI as well, but the most sort of resurgent popular area that will come to mind for the public consciousness is large language models with the generation of ChatGPT, Google Gemini, Microsoft Copilot, and so on. But there are other areas, many other disciplines within AI as well, and those two specific examples.
And you've obviously got an amazing depth of knowledge in this, but for people that maybe haven't got as much experience in this topic, why is it relevant to all of us practicing in the healthcare space at the moment?
So that's good. Another good question. We could take that back to the handling of big data. We are generating more data than ever before in healthcare. In 1950, the doubling time of the corpus of knowledge of medical data was around 50 years. If you fast forward to now, that's approximately 2 months. So the body of medical evidence and data set doubles every 2 months. So if you'd started medical school in 1950, you could go through a career before the body of knowledge doubled. Now you can start medical school and you sort of probably know a smaller proportion of that body of knowledge when you graduate than when you started. So we're generating more data all the time, and 97% of healthcare data is unused. So coincidentally, at the rise of computational power, there's that concept called George Moore. George Moore, one of the founders of IBM, observed that the number of transistors in the chip would double approximately every 2 years. So approximately the computational processing power doubles every 2 years. So there's this exponential rise in medical data, but exponential rise in computational power, which could potentially handle that data. So I think there is relevance to say, well, if we were to try and improve healthcare, we've got all this data. Could we use a processing capability, computational power, to look at that data to see if we can extract additional meaning or value from that data that we currently don't use?
Fantastic. And what's our role as clinicians in leading this in our space? Because I mean, you talked about it very nicely in the talk there, but you know, we know our clinical space very, very well. We don't necessarily know the technical space very, very well, whereas the technical industry colleagues often know that space very well, but don't perhaps know our clinical environment in the OR very well. And somehow we have to bridge that gap, don't we? So,
yeah, 100%. And I don't think that's something that we do particularly well at the minute as a healthcare professional community. If you look at the traditional technology approach, where technology is designed with in commercial entities, often with strong technology teams and commercial teams and product teams, and they produce these fantastic products, I think that model works well in the consumer space, where those people involved in the design and the evolution of those systems are also consumers. They then have inherent subject matter expertise.
This is the Apple analogy you talked about in the talk.
Exactly, where they have a philosophy of surprise and delight, where they will work away in these silos and develop the next iteration of technology, and then they will release that and they create these fantastic, beautiful products, which their sort of Steve Jobs' famous line was, tell the customer what they want. And they have done that really well and had huge success with that. I think that methodology doesn't translate well to healthcare. The reason being that most of the individuals involved in technology organizations are not clinically qualified, a very small minority. Some of them have never set foot in operating theater. Most of them have never anesthetized a patient or been called to an emergency. There's a culture, I think, that has developed in the healthcare AI space with a technology back end and a commercial front end, and then that clinical component can be quite transitory or minor. And I think actually, as healthcare experts, we need to have a leadership role in that space as the third leg of the stool. Otherwise, the stool will topple over, to say, well, we understand the problems. We understand the challenges we're facing. We also understand how to evaluate a solution to make sure it meets our clinical needs and then to implement it in the workflow. Or if the workflow needs to be changed, a clinician academic is probably best placed to implement that change, engage with the clinical community to do so. And then we collaborate with our technology, academic, industry partners and commercial partners to realize that solution, rather than a technology-led solution with ad hoc clinical input.
And you talked about it very nicely again in the talk. We have a very privileged role in engaging with industry in that space and regard, don't we?
Yeah, I think at the minute we need to sort of work on that role, I think, a little bit. We currently have a slightly siloed mentality. We're employed by a clinical entity or an academic institute, and we work on these solutions. But just like in the audience, you know, we're members of that community, and as people like you and I talking to other clinician academics, but there were few, if any, industry members of the community in that audience. The same will apply for most conferences. And in fact, one of the things that frustrates me is that in many conferences, there's the clinical academic component and the talks, which the industry, you know, element tend not to attend. And then there's the trade hall where the industry and commercial element is, and we tend to put the lunch in there to ensure that the clinician academics will go there fleetingly to engage. And actually, we need to sort of break down those silos so that we can sort of both approach it as equal partners. We have profound clinical knowledge, expertise, and understanding as a community, and they have profound commercial capability and knowledge and understanding that we don't have, and we can achieve more together rather than in silos.
And I guess the other thing is, we're hopefully going to be using this, if it is implemented and adopted, into our space. So again, coming back to the F1 analogy you gave in the room, but we should have some sort of sign off on what goes into the F1 car as the driver of it, not just the manufacturer behind the scenes.
Yeah, 100%. I think, so the analogy I gave there was that I don't know anything about Formula One. I have no inside knowledge, but I strongly suspect that Lewis Hamilton can't manufacture and engineer the Ferrari car that he drives. Yet I suspect he has a strong, if not the strongest, say in what goes into that car, how the design goes. And, you know, it says something like, there's not much enough downforce as we go into the corner, whatever you say when you drive cars fast. And then the engineers will work to deliver that solution. But he has a really significant say in how that car is designed and the performance it delivers. I think we should adopt a similar mindset as clinicians, because this space is going to involve AI-based solutions in clinical practice. If we have had no say in what they do or how they do it or how they're evaluated so we can compare A to B, then they may not address our needs. But we can't really complain about that if we haven't actively engaged. It's put very well by a friend of mine, Anthony Samo, who's a radiologist at Harvard, and we collaborate on a number of things. He said, with the rise of strategic critical importance of intelligent medical devices, medical devices have been produced by technology enterprises and used by clinicians with their medical knowledge. Now that medical knowledge is going to become part of the medical device. So clinicians need to be an active stakeholder within the development of that medical device. And another colleague of mine in London says, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So I think both those analogies hold true.
That's a great analogy. And I think there'll be some listeners listening to this at home who are going, oh, it's another AI podcast. Top Med Talk's covered that before. The AI space is already there. It's already changing. Google, Amazon, Microsoft, all those companies are all using AI. We're not using that in our health services to the same level yet. And is that just because we're behind the times, or is that because there's a different barrier moving us forwards? And is this actually going to come into our space at all, or are we always going to be a bit behind on that commercial front?
Yeah, I think we are behind some of the other areas. And there are a few factors, in my opinion, for this. One is that the healthcare space, the commercial market, and bearing in mind that I think this is often commercially driven, it's not as big a market as we perhaps think it is. It's an ever-present market. It never goes away. Travel goes away, went away during COVID. Healthcare did not, quite the reverse. You know, same during, you know, periods of war, geopolitical unrest. Healthcare will always be there. But it's not as perhaps as large as other areas. If you think about the number of cell phones in the world, there are 8 billion plus, and they will turn over every couple of years. And so manufacturers have a high incentive to say, well, that's a large market, and we're going to keep having consumables taken up. But there aren't as many as 8 billion, I'll be pretty sure, and we make them last as absolutely as long as we can, 10 years plus. So the market, although present and significant, is perhaps not as dominant or as large as we might think it is. The other aspect is that there's a very high barrier to entry. So you could put any sort of app on an iPhone, and if it's not a really good app, people won't use it. That doesn't quite work if we have a ventilator that isn't quite a very good ventilator. It doesn't really ventilate people properly. That's a big problem. And so regulators have a much higher incentive to say no to something that's good, but maybe could be potentially have some problems, than to say yes. And so there's a big barrier to entry for a highly regulated, low margin space, and the market is not as big as we perhaps first assume it is. So because of that, I think that means that the development and adoption within healthcare lags other areas. But that, I think, inherently gives us a potential advantage. This, you know, I've kind of termed it the second mover advantage, where we can see successes, challenges, failures in other areas. And well, let's adopt some of the things that worked well and try and adapt them to our space. So I think we have an opportunity here before the field, you know, escapes us, to sort of have an influence in how it evolves. Because in my mind, there's no doubt it will have an impact. It's slightly difficult to predict when, exactly how and where and in what format. But I think it will, and we should make sure we have that seat at the table, you know, to steer how it does that and when it does that.
And I guess that links to your runaway train analogy, where the train is currently still in the station, but it's going to run away soon. And I think all the mood music is there nationally, politically, you know, the new NHS 10-year plan about moving everything digitally. And that's basically saying we're going to start using AI in healthcare. But at the moment, the train's still in the station.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, that analogy, the train is in the station. We should get on board before it leaves the station, picks up steam, because once it's running, it'll be much more difficult to get on board and change the course. I mean, if we can be on board from the start, it's extraordinarily difficult to find out the way of how do you get on board and like where, how do you get to the driver's cockpit and steer it? And, you know, and it's really challenging. And I guess that is potentially good in the fact that, you know, you can't just flippantly go in and influence the course of healthcare AI. On the other hand, we really should have a strategic national coordinated role to achieve that. I don't think anyone's quite cracked the nut of how we do that, because it's such a multidisciplinary field with so many different players and competing interests, which are globally aligned, but individual interests and activities and commitments often take precedence. So I don't think anyone's quite solved the kind of problem or the challenge of like, how do we influence it really effectively, most appropriately? I've got a couple of ideas on that. One is that I think healthcare provider organizations need to take a bigger, stronger, more active role in this. The current model of the innovation pipeline is, it often starts with technological capability, and these healthcare technology organizations will seek to support their technological capacity with a bit of clinical input and advice and data provided by healthcare organizations. There's a real challenge in doing that for the obvious reasons of confidentiality, transparency, you know, what's the intended benefit of these things. Actually, I think there may be a role whereby you can say healthcare provider organizations can become the manufacturers, or at least partner in the co-development of that manufacturer, because it's probably easier to bring in technological and commercial expertise into healthcare provider organizations who inescapably have the data and the clinical expertise and the operational understanding. And it's probably easier to add in that technological and commercial capacity than it is to export our healthcare capacities. So that might be one role. And that doesn't mean it's an either or of its healthcare provider or industry. You know, healthcare providers could potentially develop some devices and tools themselves, or they can partner with organizations to say, well, let's form a strategic close alignment with all the data protection provisions and everything else that entails, but we'll work together to deliver a solution to our clinical problems.
And you highlighted a really important but fascinating point in the talk about what this partnership or work could generate, the intellectual property or the IP that's going to be produced from this, and that IP being the graveyard of all ideas, and not to go in with the IP approach when we start having these conversations, which I can personally relate to, but I suspect there's many people listening to this at home that are sitting there going, what? IP is the graveyard of ideas? Really? You want to explain that a bit more for us?
Yeah, sure. So I've been involved in these conversations on both sides, on the, you know, or all three sides, the clinical side of the kind of conversation, the academic side and the commercial side. And maybe I just notice it more when I'm operating on the commercial side, but I just notice more. But one thing that is raised often early is the concept of IP, ownership, revenue share, these kind of things. And I think that is such a bad philosophy, because it will kill an idea. As soon as, you know, my analogy in the talk was like, you start dating someone, you don't sort of say on the third date, right, let's just get some plans in place for if we get married and then divorced, who, you know, he keeps the dog. That's not the best place to start. The best place to start is, well, let's date a bit more and see if we like each other and see how things evolve. I think we could do that much more effectively in this sort of triumvirate of academia, healthcare, and industry if we say, well, let's bring to the table, this is what I've got. So as a healthcare provider organization or a clinician, we've got deep expertise in this. We've got data on that. We've got research funded in this area, generating these publications. We've got these great ideas. Perhaps what we don't have at the minute is the commercial expertise or some of the technological expertise to realize it and operationalize it and commercialize it. So I think we should go in, set off on the right foot. And so we can approach these organizations and say, I'm really active in this space. You happen to make whatever device it is, ventilators, for example. We've got a lot of data around this, and we've kind of thought about how we could reimagine this and take this further to the next level. Does this interest you? And then you sort of find a natural willing partner. You might have some discussions which don't work and then some which do. And then you find some areas where the Venn diagram overlaps and you think, okay, so we've got that overlapping area of interest, that mutual interest. Why don't we start with some low-hanging, easy fruit that doesn't require a big financial or time or resource commitment from either side? For example, you've got a device that you particularly like using, the manufacturer makes that device. So, well, why don't, let's say, for example, you want to the manufacturer wants to sell more of those devices and you want to sort of see it used properly, you can say, well, why don't we kind of work together? We'll deliver some project on seeing, evaluating how we use it, how we implement it, what effect that has on the patient care, the health economics, or whatever it might be. And then you can publish that, present it, you know, there's some engagement on both sides. The manufacturer might say, well, that's really valuable to us. Actually, what else could we do? Or we kind of, you know, we're thinking about making the next iteration of that device. Some of your people are familiar with using it and they've got some ideas. Maybe you guys could kind of give us some pointers, some thoughts, and you sort of start with that easy, low barrier sort of approach. That idea of starting with, we've got this thing, we need £10 million, and by the way, we want to own the revenue. That's going to be a much harder way to move forward rather than starting with the easy, lower yield, rather than starting with the easy, high yield, low hanging fruit that we could then build on.
I couldn't agree more. I think whenever I get to that question, it's inevitably on every ethics application or grants application, and there's always the box about, is any IP going to be generated from this? And it's just a heart sink moment, isn't it? Because, I mean, the whole point of doing some of these projects is we don't know where some, I mean, we've got ideas, but it is an unknown. And to put so much weight on that one important, but, you know, small part of the picture at such an early stage.
I totally agree. And I think part of this is driven by the fact that the UK is facing strong economic headwinds with weak, anemic economic growth. Historically, hospitals and academic institutes, if we go back 50 plus years, have been well funded by a high performing economy, and that's changing in the world. And so academic and healthcare institutes are sort of needing to find different ways to revenue generate. But if we start with that IP problem and place that front and center, then that's going to kill the ideation process and the evolution, the iteration. If we start with the idea and then build on it, I think that's going to be much more successful, but it requires commitment and awareness. There won't be an immediate return. We're not going to, within 12 months, suddenly have all these additional revenue streams which we didn't have previously. But we're going to have to see where your project goes, where someone else's project goes, and some of them will generate, you know, really valuable IP and revenue, but not all of them with. But you've got to kick the tires to sort of understand which one will and which one won't. And I think that's a much better long-term approach than the short-term approach of saying, right, let's find out who owns the IP and make sure we own it. Because it's much better to have a smaller proportion of something large than everything of nothing.
So I think as we come to a close, I just want to pivot slightly, and rather than looking at the detail of the AI ideas, let's think a bit more on sort of a national scale. We can look at the UK first and maybe even internationally, but what are we doing at the college level, at the association level, nationally in the UK to sort of get ourselves on this AI train before it leaves the station? And how can people at home listening to this contribute to that?
So one of the activities I'm leading in partnership with the association and partnership with the Royal College of Anaesthetists, as well as UCL Partners, this innovation organization in London, is a national demand signaling project for AI in anaesthesia, perioperative medicine, and acute pain. The idea is founded in what we've just discussed, this concept that the innovation pipeline starts with technological capability. And I think we need to invert that and say, let's start with the clinical problem. Don't worry about the AI for now. That may or may not be a useful solution to our problems, but we'll come to that later. Let's start with the problems first. So we're surveying all anaesthetists in the UK and Ireland through those membership organisations to say, tell us about the pain points in your clinical practice. What are the issues? What are the challenges you face? What are the barriers? Just think about that for now. And you, we're completing a survey where we're saying to them, please fill out that survey. Tell us what the issues are. The next stages of that will be, once we have those suggestions and the survey is coming to a close at the end of November, we will then curate them, because of course some will be in scope, some will be out of scope, many of them will be duplicates because more than one person will come up with the same good idea. We'll curate those suggestions and go through a Delphi-style nominal ranking process with clinician representatives of those organizations we're partnering with. We'll then rank them and identify a sort of top 10. And of course, it doesn't mean idea number 11 is bad, but it's just a way of trying to handle what I suspect will be a larger number of suggestions than we can do at any one time. So we'll prioritize them nominally into a top 10. And then during this process, we'll start to bring in the multidisciplinary stakeholder kind of input, because we haven't started. We started with clinicians because I think it's unfair to say to patients, what are the main problems in clinical practice of anesthesia? Because many of them don't know what an anesthetist is or does, and it's a specialist area, you know, within a specialist area. So we'll start with the clinicians, start to bring in the multidisciplinary perspective. So the patients, the healthcare provider organizations, where's their main problem that they can foresee in the next 5, 10 years? Where's their capital allocation going to be? What are the problems they need to solve? The technology experts, the commercial experts, because of course there's no point us coming up with the top 10 that the commercial field says, well, there's no money in any of that, so we're not going to do any of it. We said the patients, the regulators, the policymakers, because again, they have an important say. So we've got this sort of multidisciplinary stakeholder group, and we're going to culminate in sort of Q1, Q2 of 2026, where we will have this multidisciplinary stakeholder meetings and say, we've got a top 10, and we said we wanted whatever it was, smart ventilators. Well, what does a smart ventilator mean? What does it do? What are the limits of its performance? What do we need it to kind of achieve in order for it to be useful? Those kind of things. So we can sort of flesh out those ideas, and that will evolve input from all those stakeholder groups, and then we'll sort of present those. So that's one starting point, and we're starting with the clinical problems, and then we aim to build on that by saying, okay, well, we said the smart ventilator idea, and this is what it does. And through this process, we've engaged manufacturers of ventilators, we've engaged policymakers, we've engaged healthcare organizations which buy ventilators. Well, let's say, let's go on and prototype this concept to see if we can kind of iterate and develop something and really do a nationally coordinated strategy which places the clinical problem at the heart of that innovation pipeline.
Fantastic. So really exciting times ahead. And again, thank you very much for coming to join us today here on Top Med Talk. We'll look forward to seeing how that process develops over the coming months and years, and hopefully maybe we'll be able to get you back again and give us an update a bit further down the line with how things have progressed again.
I'd love to. We can update you on the results and our kind of future plans. That'd be a real pleasure. So thanks for inviting me today.
Thank you for listening at home. As always, you can find this episode and all our other episodes on topmedtalk.com on our website. Top Med Talk is on all the main social media platforms. If you do find us on social media, whether that's Facebook or Instagram or LinkedIn, please do hit the thumbs up, hit subscribe, hit like. It really makes a difference to us at this end. Keeping everything free and open access around the world obviously relies heavily on our sponsors too. So I'd always like to thank BD and GE Healthcare, who are sponsoring us this year. And thank you very much to you for listening.
Top Med Talk.
Top Med Talk is the broadcasting arm of EdPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. Join clinicians from around the world at EdPOM World Congress 2026 between the 7th and the 9th of July at the British Library in London. 3 days of evidence-based perioperative medicine, global insights and expert debate, featuring speakers including Michael Marmot and Ken Rockwood. Go now to edpom.org. That's edpom.org.
Thanks for listening, and to the team for Top Med Talk for that fantastic conversation. If you did like this and found it useful, please do have a look at our episode description and go and have a look at their channel. It's certainly one that I listen to and has some really good insights on it. Otherwise, please do subscribe to Anesthesia on Air for more anesthetic-related podcasts. We hope to see you soon.